Can you all hear me? Okay, I can hear myself. They highlighted the quotation is one indication of Huxley's breaking ranks with his evolutionary colleagues over this issue of evolutionary ethics, the lecture I'll be discussing from 1893. This is the theater, the outside view, where he spoke. In the afternoon of May 18th, and forgive me for rushing through a lot of text, I'm not intending to read it all, I'm not intending for you to read it all, and I'm leaving out the footnotes. Anyway, May 18th, 1893, Oxford University, Sheldonian Theater, Darwin's bulldog rose to deliver his last public lecture, Evolution and Ethics. His voice, weakened by age, illness, and infirmity, was almost inaudible. However, his message, embedded in long, complex arguments, soon became clear. Nature did not provide us with moral norms. In the name of morality, Huxley rejected evolutionary ethics, opposing what he called the gladiatorial theory of existence, with all its creaturely suffering, struggle, pain, sorrow, and death. Here's a picture of him in 1893, the year he delivered this lecture. This is an outline of my talk. Skip right through it and pause it once in a while. Starting here, Huxley is very famous for trashing theology, trashing the church, very anti-Christian, very agnostic, he coined the word. But I'm also calling him a religious Victorian scientific naturalist. Scientific naturalist is another phrase for him. So he had a lot of good things to say about religion. As a young scientist, he grew increasingly skeptical about traditional Christian beliefs and literalistic readings of the Bible that he was trained with as a youngster. In a letter of 1847 to his future wife, Henrietta, he spoke about matters of faith and science, arguing that one's convictions depended crucially on trustworthy evidence. So it's not only important what you believe, but how did you arrive at that belief? And note how he talks, this agnostic. Of this, the almighty searcher of hearts can alone judge. Quick footnote, Henrietta was a pious woman raised and educated in the evangelical Moravian Church. She had a solid religious education. She knew modern languages and ancient languages like Huxley did. And unusually, she was trained in the natural sciences as a girl in the 19th century. She was also a woman of prayer. And going through her spiritual diary, you'll note that she often intercedes for her husband. She's worried about his views as he distances himself from Christianity and the church. Here he is in 1857. He's a fellow of the Royal Society. He's a brand new professional scientist, and he's been married for 2 years. In 1859, there's some remarkable statements he published. He said, "Our faith in the right working of the human mind rests on no mere testimony. But there is one that bears witness to it, and he the highest. For every scientific discovery we make, it is, if this world be governed by providential order, the direct testimony of that providence. That is, that providence God has endowed us with faculties to do science. Scientific achievements are so many signs and wonders," Huxley said, "whereby the divine government signifies his approbation. Love of truth is a divine necessity. With that love, the human intellect is the nearest personification of the divine. Without that, it is the worst of conceivable devils. True science and true religion are twin sisters, and the separation of either from the other is sure to prove the death of both." So he had a very strong sense of science as a religious vocation. But in his review of the first edition of Darwin's Origin, he infamously wrote in an early version of the Victorian Warfare thesis, "Extinguished theologians lie about the cradle of every science as the strangled snakes beside that of Hercules. And history records that whenever science and Christian orthodoxy have been fairly opposed, the latter has been forced to retire from the lists, bleeding and crushed if not annihilated, scotched if not slain." He could be playful, as in this sketch of Darwin as the Pope of the Church Scientific in 1868. Overtly, he formed to a good C of E sort of family man. Next, I want to quickly review evolutionary ethics, which boils down to following nature as the foundation of our morality. This was the question for Huxley, whether or not there is or is not a sanction for morality in the ways of the cosmos. He did not want that question to make. Here's Darwin in 1854. He's already working on the book that would become his Origin of Species. Oops. Here's a copy of the first edition. On the page facing the title page, there are two theological quotations. A month later, for the second edition, a third theological quotation was added. This place his entire argument within the framework of Christian natural theology. And you can see that throughout the Origin. By the way, the subtitle of the Origin, The Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life, would become content as the decades rolled on. At the point of the publication of the Origin, Darwin was no longer practicing Christian, but he was certainly an evolutionary theist at the very least. He called himself a theist, T-H. He believed God was creator to design the laws of nature, and through those laws of nature, such as natural selection, the animal world was being slowly perfected. He has an evolutionary theodicy, therefore. Progress through pain. So he concludes the Origin, thus from the war of nature, from famine and death, the most exalted object which we are capable of conceiving, namely the production of the higher animals, directly follows. You see, he adds breathing life into the first organisms by the Creator. With the second edition, he adds that. Here's Darwin in 1874. He's finished the final edition of the Origin and the second edition of The Descent of Man. Title page of the first edition of 1871. In that book, in volume one, he discusses the origins and evolutions of what he calls the moral sense or the conscience. Huxley saw two fallacies at work in moves to argue not for the evolution of ethics, which he granted, but for the ethics of evolution. First, Huxley argued the immoral sentiments have no less been evolved than the moral ones. The thief and the murderer follow nature just as much as the philanthropist. Cosmic nature may teach us how the good and the evil tendencies of man may have come about, but in itself it is incompetent to furnish any better reason why what we call good is preferable to what we call evil and poor. Second, Huxley, who had earlier published a monograph on David Hume, who first noticed this fallacy, objected to the slippage from the evolutionary or natural is to the ethical ought. Just because creatures have advanced in perfection by means of the struggle for existence, the survival of the fittest, Huxley argued, it does not logically follow that men as ethical beings must look to the same process to help them toward perfection. Believing it, that it does leads to some dangerous thinking. Here's Darwin in The Descent. With savages, whom he earlier called the lower races, the weakened body and mind were soon eliminated. On the other hand, we civilized types, we do our utmost to check nature's process of elimination, so we care for the imbecile, the maimed, the sick, the poor, who go on to propagate their kind. This is injurious to the race, excepting in the case of man himself, hardly anyone is so ignorant as to allow his worst animals to be. Sounds eugenic, doesn't it? His cousin Francis Galton, the father of eugenics, saw it as a matter of both scientific and religious duty, the breeding of better humans and the elimination of those judged to be less evolved, inferior, unfit. This is Herbert Spencer, great agnostic and evolutionary philosopher, who coined the phrase survival of the fittest. He's a governmental minimalist and a social Darwinist. You don't see government helping deer escape from tigers. So why should the government help people in society escape their suffering? In a number of books, he saw evolution as our moral guide. Beneficence was built into the natural order of things. Too bad with that merciless Malthusian struggle for existence, weeding out the weaker and less fit in nature and in society. But that's the way the world works, or it ought to work at least, because we must conform and indeed submit to the laws of nature. In a later essay which served as the second half of Evolution and Ethics, Huxley wrote that guided by purely scientific considerations, the hopelessly diseased, the infirm agent, the weak or deformed in body or in mind, the excess of infants born would be put away as the gardener pulls up defective and superfluous plants. Only the strong and the healthy would be permitted to reproduce. Whose everlasting creditor, Huxley rejected the eugenic trajectory of his friend's evolutionary ethics, not only because he found them immoral, but because he believed, I think wisely, that there was no hope that we would ever gain the wisdom and intelligence to decide who should live and who should die. He was fitted on. We are always liable to error. This is a non-theist, an anti-Christian saying, until original sin is rooted out of us, every child born will still bring with it the instinct of unlimited self-assertion. And yet, there's all sorts of inner contradictions in Huxley's thought. He couldn't entirely resist the lure of post-Malthusian evolutionary ethics. In the prologue of evolutionary ethics, he wrote that it's both obvious and desirable that the interests of society should be in the hands of the fittest, the most energetic, the most intelligent, people like me. Insofar as struggle tends to place such men in possession of wealth and influence, it tends to the good of society. This is another statement of his overt thesis in evolution and ethics. He undermines himself in various ways, but that's it in simplest words. Huxley's paradox, I'm calling it, is we are part of nature. We're deeply embedded in nature. So how could we, as natural products of the cosmic evolutionary process, revolt against that same process? His dilemma is that he rejected nature on one hand and God on the other as moral authorities and lots of stuff in between. So on what basis could he make such a moment of judgments? In his book on Hume, he states an ethical position that he maintains 14 years later in his essay. He wrote in 1879, morality is based on feeling, not on reason. Justice is founded on the love of one's neighbor, goodness, kind of beauty. The moral law rests in the long run upon instinctive intuitions. So what is he left with? Moral judgments deal not in facts but feelings. He's left with a version of moral intuitionism. But again, how could a godless, purposeless cosmos give rise to a species with trustworthy moral intuitions that contradicted the cosmic processes that created that species? If moral intuitions have evolved, they're natural. Then how could nature, at worst actively hostile, at best morally indifferent, teach us ethics? Huxley ruled out. Whose intuitions are we to prefer? Can they be justified? How do we avoid the slide into moral subjectivism and relativism? This section, I want to highlight a few of the inner tensions in his thought about nature and God. In 1860, his firstborn four-year-old son Noel died. Charles Kingsley, one of his clerical friends, wrote him a letter of condolence and hoped for his sake that there would be a post-resurrection reunion. Huxley did not believe in life after death and replied, science seems to me to teach in the highest and strongest manner the great truth which is embodied in the Christian conception of entire surrender to the will of God. Sit down before fact as a little child. Follow humbly wherever nature leads. That is how I have found peace of mind. I have the firmest belief that the divine government is wholly just. The ledger of the Almighty is strictly kept. Nature is juster than we, so sadly, without bitterness, he says, he accepts his child's death. In an 1868 essay, we developed a chess metaphor for understanding nature as more angelic than satanic. The chessboard's the world, the rules of the game are what we call the laws of nature. The player on the other side is hidden from us. We know that his play is always fair, just, and patient, but we also know to our cost that he never overlooks a mistake. He's alluding to this picture by Retzsch from 1839. Satan on the left is playing a chess with a man's soul while an angel looks on. Substitute for the mocking fiend in that picture, calm, strong angel who is playing for love and who would rather lose than that I should accept it as an image of human life. This is the same essay in which he said that the most valuable kind of education is training in the practice of obedience to the moral laws of nature. But he also thought of nature and the possible creator as anything but angelic and ethical. In a letter to Darwin, he wrote, if we are to assume that anyone has designedly set this wonderful universe going, it is perfectly clear to me that he is no more entirely benevolent and just than that he is malevolent and unjust. In an 1890 essay, he quotes, let dogs delight to bark and bite, for 'tis their nature to. Let bears and lions growl and fight, for God had made them so. Well, if God creates species like that, he seems to, and Huxley references cats, he seems to delight in making rather sadistic butchers. We owed our success in the struggle for existence, Huxley wrote, to the qualities we share with the ape and the tiger, such as cunning, ruthlessness, ferocity. But the promptings of the ape and tiger within us are sins, he said, and not reconcilable with sound ethical principles. There is this constant battle going on inside us. Despite his thesis, he ended his 1890 lecture with an expression of an evolutionary theodicy, that is, pain and sorrow are intrinsic to the natural order. Ultimately, suffering, struggle, inequality, extinction are to be accepted, for that is nature's path to evolutionary progress. I want to uncover a few of Huxley's ironies in the next few minutes. In 1854, he first described himself in a letter to a friend as a scientific Calvinist. He lived in a deterministic universe. He was really big on predestination, foreordination, knowledge, before existence. Pain is everywhere inevitable, therefore to be born. That's my scientific Calvinism, along with some Stoicism. In 1870, he wrote, I protest that if some great power would agree to make me always think what is true and do what is right on condition of being turned into a sort of clockwork man without free will, I should instantly accept the offer. The only freedom I care about is the freedom to do right. And then, for a fairly materialistic sort of fellow, he trashes the materialism. Here's one in a private letter, one of many, many statements regarding sin and its sad consequences. It's a lifelong theme of his thought. In an essay called Science and Morals, he wrote of his real and living belief, his firm and lively faith in the fixed order of nature which certifies our morality. Next year, he wrote about the intellectual love of God that science leads us to. He wrote, order is Lord of all. Elsewhere, he wrote that same year, that scientists sought the rational order which pervades the universe, which both ancient Greeks and Christians would identify with the God of Logos. Nature's ordained lawful order was a sacred belief for Huxley the agnostic, one that left room for versions of purpose, design, and providence. Like Darwin, Huxley located God's design not in particular details, but in nature's universal laws. It was, in fact, a species of natural theology, see Darwin and Huxley. And so what he saw in science was a moral vocation, a kind of religious devotion. His evangelical upbringing is key to my conclusion. Huxley's mother, Rachel, whom he adored, bequeathed to her son a pious, earnest, restless, questioning, truth-seeking spiritual life. In an 1847 letter to her son, she hoped that in his scientific researches he would recognize the God of nature by his works and providences, and also strengthen his inner faithful convictions. Huxley's beloved elder sister, Lizzie, played a major role in his religious upbringing. He was brought to church on Sundays, listened to countless sermons. In 1889, he recalled, I was brought up in the strictest school of evangelical orthodoxy, and when I was old enough to think for myself, I started upon my journey of inquiry with little doubt about the general truth of what I had been taught. Such an upbringing, despite the shedding of specifically Christian theology, left its mark on Huxley in many ways. He idolized the vicar of his local parish church, and in imitation of this pastor, he recalls as a child, I remember turning my pinafore wrong side forwards in order to represent a surplus and preaching to my mother's maids in the kitchen one Sunday morning. That's the earliest indication of the strong clerical affinities which my friend Herbert Spencer has always ascribed to me. One good example of this, one Sunday evening in 1866 in St. Martin's Hall, Huxley, sponsored by the Lord's Day Observance Society, processed to the lectern while a church organist played the sacred strains of Joseph Haydn's creation. He spoke of a moral duty to advance natural knowledge. The lecture was presented as a lay sermon and was reprinted in a book called Lay Sermons. Here's a remarkable essay he wrote in 1892 on his late in life convictions. If the doctrine of a providence is to be taken as the total exclusion of chance and nature, if it means the conviction that the cosmic process is rational, the faith that throughout alteration, unbroken order has reigned in the universe, I not only accept it, but I am disposed to think it the most important of all truths. And if the cosmic process was set going by some super entity, possessed of intelligence, foresight, would know every event in the future universe before it even was created, he says science has no problem with that. Such a providence, he said, generated morality in us and provided us with a changed destiny. I'm skipping over all sorts of stuff, more theological stuff. Get this paragraph. This is Huxley. The doctrines of predestination, of original sin, of the innate depravity of man, of the primacy of Satan in this world, of a benevolent Almighty who has revealed himself, faulty as they are, appear to be vastly nearer the truth than liberal illusions that babies are all good. Here's a picture of in 1893 looking sort of somber. His thoughts full of cross currents and undercurrents, the anti-Christian polemicist greatly admired the Hebrew prophets and Jesus' teachings. He publicly long advocated the study of the Bible and its teaching in schools. The skeptical agnostic had a deep and lifelong religious streak, and including a very strong sense of sin, personal and social. A reviewer of his essay admired his egg dance in preaching a doctrine that either ignored or rejected Christianity, even though, quote, in its essential character, it's an approximation to the Pauline dogma of nature and grace. The chief irony, perhaps this thinking should be obvious by now, what were the deliverances of his natural moral intuitions? After reading them for 40 years, it took me just a minute to list from his letters, from his writings. These are the values he lived by. He taught his children. He advocated in public and in private. Look them over. Did any of them look familiar? They represent Christian moral values that he intuited naturally. They're not exclusively Christian, all of them, of course. Still, near the end of his life, the morality Huxley, the agnostic, scientific naturalist, taught looked very much like the morality he acquired from his evangelical upbringing, from his devout mother and elder sister, and reinforced by his beloved and pious wife, Nettie, as well as various close friendships with Christians and theologians of all kinds. I want to end by focusing on what I see as the tragedy in this story. Sadly prophetic, in a letter after his lecture, he wrote, "My lecture is really an effort to put the Christian doctrine that Satan is the prince of this world upon a scientific foundation." Tragically, Huxley convinced neither his peers nor subsequent generations of philosophers and biologists of his overt thesis that the struggle, suffering, and selection by which evolution operates should not be replicated in society. His unfortunate failure left the door open to early 20th century legitimations of the darker implications of Darwinism, unleashing in science and law a variety of related racist and militarist ideologies, including eugenics, social Darwinism, racial hygiene movement, and genocidal Nazism, not to mention the recent resurgence of atheistic evolutionary ethics, evolutionary psychology, that is outstanding, and revived arguments for eugenics. This is where he ended up. His grave, buried beside his brother George, next to his young son Noel's grave. An old friend, the Reverend John Lowe Davies, wrote the service. And this I find interesting, and this is how I'll close. He asked Huxley, the great agnostic, the great unbeliever, asked, these words from his wife be inscribed on his stone. Be not afraid, ye waiting hearts that weep, for still he giveth his beloved sleep. And if an endless sleep he wills, so best. Amen.
Animals. I mean, he goes on very strongly to say that to apply this to human society would involve the deterioration of the best part of our nature and would be a present overwhelming evil.
Including up until this morning, just cutting it back fit into the time center. I included that for several reasons. One, because it's not unique in the descent of man. You can find other passages like that. And he continues to quote as authorities people like Galton. He was certainly read in eugenicist and racist ways. And one of the exercises I used to do with my students was show passages from Hitler's Mein Kampf and Darwin's Descent, and they could never tell who was saying what. So, I'm not saying Darwin was a Nazi. I am saying, however, Nazis used the descent as a cultural and scientifically legitimate resource for their ideology.
But only by ignoring Darwin.
Well, picking and choosing, which is what happens with everybody.
Yeah.
That's a good point. And it was in the original version of that. Scientific work, Darwinism rarely is used. He just did a kind of science, a kind of biology that was not dependent on that particular evolutionary way of thinking. And of course, he was famously very ambivalent about the key mechanism of natural selection. So in 1860, he read the delicious irony of Bishop Samuel Wilberforce arguing for natural selection and Huxley arguing against it. The only, you tick Darwin off, but Huxley, the most he would go and say, this is a good provisional hypothesis, but he was not going to say, yeah, natural selection is it. And through six editions of The Origin, of course, Darwin kept weakening natural selection and adding other possible mechanisms. We have to revolt against ourselves. Gene, there you go. Good boy, I didn't do that.
But the question for you, Paul, what is the third Wiley quotation rather than the second?
The first was a quotation from William Ewell. Second, from Bridgewater Rodriguez. Second was from Francis Bacon, Advancement of Learning, with the two books. Third one was from Joseph Butler. Both Huxley and Darwin loved this book of natural theology. Joseph Butler, a bishop in the 18th century, wrote The Analogy of Religion. And both Huxley and Darwin loved this. And one of the things that Butler mentions, I think, is the existence of laws of nature implies a